I am Luis Martinez Fernandez, professor of history at the University of Central Florida, and you're listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast.
Ocala.
Tavares.
Daytona Beach.
Oviedo.
Apopka.
Orlando.
Lake Helen.
Winter Park.
Eustis.
Sanford.
Welcome to the Riches Documentary Podcast. Riches, the regional initiative for collecting the histories, experience, and stories of Central Florida, is an umbrella program housing interdisciplinary public history projects that bring together different departments at the University of Central Florida with profit and nonprofit sectors of the community in order to promote the collection and preservation of the region's history. By facilitating research that records and presents the stories of communities, businesses, and institutions in Central Florida, Riches seeks to provide the region with a deeper sense of its heritage. This series will feature a podcast every 2 weeks, in the middle and at the end of each month, that will explore various aspects of Central Florida history. In today's episode, Remembering Orlando, an interview with Joy Wallace Dickinson. Joy Wallace Dickinson gives a tour through the rich and diverse history of Orlando based off her unique personal experience and professional research and work. From artists and historical buildings to gangsters and gambling, Dickinson proves that the local history of Orlando is fascinating and exciting in this two-part podcast.
The city of Orlando and the greater Central Florida area is rich with diverse and fascinating history. Joy Wallace Dickinson, who has been a writer for the Orlando Sentinel for the past 10 years, has published both newspaper articles and several books about the history of Central Florida. Joy Dickinson agreed to sit down and discuss her experiences and tales of Orlando, based off of her book, Remembering Orlando, Tales from Elvis to Disney. Could you introduce and tell us a little bit about yourself?
My name's Joy Wallace Dickinson. I write about Central Florida history, and I started that really about 10 years ago, around the year 2000, when I was working at the Sentinel, at the Orlando Sentinel, and I sort of inherited a column called Florida Flashback that had been in the paper for a long time, had been done by other folks before me, but it appeared weekly and sort of stresses interesting aspects of Central Florida's past. So I've done that for 10 years, and I have published 3 books. One of them is a photo history. One of them is called Orlando City of Dreams, which is a history with a lot of photos of the Orlando area. And the third is called Remembering Orlando, Tales from Elvis to Disney. And that's some of the collected, edited, but collected columns that I've published specifically on the period after World War II through 1971.
What time period did you choose to focus on in your book, and why?
I find a lot of people are interested in and perhaps nostalgic about, for lack of a better word, the 50s and 60s, and it was a time that I can remember real well from growing up here, and also a time of a lot of change. And when I looked back at my flashbacks, there were a lot of interesting things that happened in that period, and so I decided to focus on that.
You said in your book that you first experienced Orlando in early September 1949. What do you remember about Orlando then? And how has it changed since then?
My family and I moved to Orlando in September 1949 when I was a small child. I do remember it real well. And we moved from Pennsylvania. My mom and I rode on the train. And growing up then in the 50s and the time we arrived, it was really small. My mom could remember very well. There was a sign near the city limits or somewhere that said, we hope to make 35,000 or something in population by so-and-so. And that may not be exactly right, but it was in the 30-something thousand for the city of Orlando. So it was very small. And but one of the things that I like to tell people about it then was I really dislike sometimes people sort of portray Orlando at that time as a sort of bumpkin little town where nothing happened. Whereas in fact, it was small, but the downtown area was a very active retail center. And there were a lot of restaurants, a lot of shopping, big department stores, a lot of people downtown. It was a real active commercial center for not only Orange County, but the counties around. People would come into downtown Orlando to shop. There was a lot of, there was some ethnic diversity. There were delis and restaurants and also some nightlife. So it was, it had a more of a community center than it did later on. It really was an active but small town, it's true.
What is your favorite vintage building in Central Florida and why?
Well, I mentioned arriving on the train when I was a child, in part because my favorite, I've got quite a few favorite buildings, but I suspect the favorite is the station, the train station that's now the Amtrak station on Sly Boulevard. It was built in 1926. And I think it's considered still the finest example of Spanish Mediterranean architecture from the 20s, at least in a commercial building that survives. And in the 50s, particularly when grandparents would come and visit, that's where we'd always go meet them. And if I ever chain myself to any building in front of bulldozers, it'll be that one. There are some other ones, and we could go back and name some of those. I'm real fond of the building that's Howard Junior High School. That used to be Orlando High. I didn't go to high school there. I did go to junior high school there. And that's a neat building. There's quite a few.
What other buildings would you chain yourself to?
Well, one, I talked about downtown being a thriving commercial center in the 50s, and I think two buildings that come to mind, that one would be the other two that I'd probably chain myself to, would be that there are two four-story brick buildings at the intersection of Orange Avenue and Central, which is sort of the old historic center of downtown Orlando, and those were thriving department stores at that time. I mean, they were older than that. The one on the east side was Yaldrew Ivies and then Ivies. The one on the other side was Dixon and Ives. And those were really both sort of centers of retail life. There were a lot of other stores, but in the 50s, and I have a lot of good memories about those.
Could you tell us about your experiences growing up with the segregation and racial tension that you witnessed in Central Florida?
I've been thinking a lot about Orlando during segregation days recently because this year, 2010, was the 50th, I think, anniversary of the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird, the novel, which came out in 1960. And it's not about Florida, but still most people growing up in the South at that time can identify with the themes that it has. And I have, been reflecting on what it was like then. I can remember very clearly, and it seems so strange and remarkable now, but the train station, for example, we were talking about that, had two waiting rooms, two identical waiting rooms on either side of it, big. One was One was marked colored only, and the other was marked white only. And that was real typical. Everything was very segregated. And I am embarrassed to say that I think I was such a self-absorbed high school student even that I wasn't aware in the early 60s, during the Kennedy years, for example, of some of the civil rights activity that was going on here at the time. Then it was not very public, and Orlandoans really liked to compliment themselves that they never had violence here, they never had any kind of violent confrontations like St. Augustine had, for example, over sit-ins and integration. But I think that's partly because there was a real feeling, particularly at the paper, which I've worked for, that those things shouldn't be publicized because that would maybe only incite more violence. Now, I've always had the feeling that one of the long ongoing themes in Orlando's history and the Orlando area's history, and it's not alone in this in Florida, was the desire to be appealing to tourists, to northern tourists. So anything that, as opposed to some other areas in the South that were not tourist attractions, even way before Disney, I think there was always a great influence here and feeling among the city fathers that we did not want to appear to be a southern hick area. We wanted to, you know, appear to be progressive, but I think in some ways that maybe just masked what was going on or needed to go on.
When did you start becoming more aware of the struggles and racial issues around you?
I was really first aware, I think, of some of this when I went to college at FSU, and I can remember very well the first African-American basketball player. What it was a huge deal, was the first African-American on any sports team there. This would have been in the late 60s. And he was not greeted with universal applause. So it was a very strange time. On the other hand, I think this is somewhat of a cliche about the South during those times, but it's also true that individual Black and white families might get to know each other better then than they did, you know, in more modern times. And that's partly because, and this is unfortunate, a lot of the dynamics were the Black family was working for the white family. But it still did mean that people knew each other and respected each other on a personal basis. So might know each other a little bit more than might be the case in other places.
Could you tell us about Eola Plaza and its significance?
One of the interesting buildings that when we were talking about downtown Orlando being a thriving commercial center in the 50s, and one of the first buildings that I can remember very well that was built on Lake Eola, around Lake Eola Park, that was a high rise, was started out as the Eola Plaza Hotel, and it was built on the corner near the children's playground, and it's still there. It's just now, it's an apartment building, I think, or condos that are part of what's called a post-parkside apartments. But I think it was built around 1950, 1951, and for a long while, it was the only high-rise building around Lake Eola. And had nightclubs in it, fancy restaurants, and was definitely considered the place to be. And a couple of the neat things that happened there was at the hotel, which went through different owners and different names. A lot of people call it the Cherry Plaza when they look back, because a man named Cherry owned it for a time. So when old-time Orlandoans remember it, they'll call it by different names. But one of the neat things that happened there was it was the site of one of the press conferences that Walt Disney had to announce the arrival or the plans to build Disney World. And that was in the 60s when rumors had been running rampant, and they Disney finally decided to come out and say that, yes, they were the mystery company that had been buying up so much land. They had a press conference there. And President Johnson stayed at the plaza when he visited here and campaigned for his election. So it had an interesting role. Later on, and this is relatively recently, in the 80s and 90s, it was an apartment building and sort of was, I think, seen as one of the spots of urbanism in downtown Orlando. But it has a neat history.
Thank you for listening to the Riches Documentary Podcast. Feel free to contact us with any questions or comments on the program that you just heard. Please join us for the next episode, Remembering Orlando, an interview with Joy Wallace Dickinson, Part 2.
Tells me.
Bombay.
Geneva.
Paris.
Vero Beach.
Danello.